and welcome to Manx Radio's General Election Candidate Interview Series. I'm Amy Griffiths and I'm our election producer. In a few short weeks, the island will decide who should have a seat in the House of Keys for the next 5 years. To help you decide who to vote for, we've invited all the candidates to take part in a 30-minute interview. Today we're hearing from Hugo Yates, who's standing in Douglas North. He's been speaking to Phil Gorn.
Falch erugus rias cajun sheas feed. Today I'm talking to Hugo Yates, who's standing for the first time in the constituency of Douglas North. And I suppose most people will want to know the obvious question. Why on earth do you want to be an MHK?
Well, that's a very good question. Thank you for asking. It's a kind of... I don't really want to be an MHK. I feel that I need to be an MHK. I've seen that the direction that the island is going in the last 5 years, and I don't think we're going in the right path. I think we need to address course and set the ship straight, really.
And obviously, that's a thing that I would imagine most wannabe MHKs might say.
Yeah.
The existing MHKs no doubt will have similar lines that, well, you know, we've done our best, but we think that we need another 5 years to do something similar and so on and so forth. What particularly is it about you that means you're going to succeed where others potentially have failed?
Well, I work in IT. I do a lot of management for IT. So I deal with complex systems, I deal with solving solutions, and I deliver those results. So I'm used to delving in deep into problems and finding the best solution for what needs to be done.
What do you see the role of an MHK being? What is the fundamental purpose of having MHKs, would you say?
It's to listen to the public, to govern, and to come up with the best solutions that works for everybody.
And why do you suppose that that's not always as easy as it sounds in a simple soundbite?
You can't please everyone all of the time, can you? Mm. That's the other issue. You're always going to get some people that think you're going the wrong way and some people who think you're doing the right thing. But it's trying to find that fine line that needs to be done.
Indeed, and many have looked for that fine line and failed to find it. In terms then of the government at the moment, I mean, it's easy to find the things that that the public will criticise about government. Does the government get anything right, do you think? And if so, what?
That's a good question, isn't it? I think the last 5 years, if we look at it back, I think we have seen a real sudden change in the last few months of policy, and I think that's a panic reaction. So I think they're trying to right the ship at the moment, but I think it's a little bit too late for that.
So I guess then the answer is that there isn't anything that positive you could say about the government.
Not at the moment, I'm afraid.
Okay. And then are there any MHKs in the past that have inspired you, or any political leaders, any political figures globally that have inspired you?
I've seen a few of the MHKs, and I quite like the ones that engage quite openly with the public, that are seeking people's opinions. I think that's what's needed. I think government has become a little bit deaf to what people actually want and need.
And is it possible in current circumstances? Obviously, we've got all kinds of financial difficulties at the moment, stagnating economy due in part at least to the war in Ukraine, and all kinds of other possibly self-inflicted wounds that the world is trying to grapple with. I mean, is it possible for government to come up with good solutions that are going to result in people feeling much better and much happier?
For us, yes, I believe so.
And what sort of things?
Well, I think at the moment the problem we've got is our government is working mainly for itself. It's driving money into itself through a number of sources. And I think if we turn those around and then government's working more for the people and less for itself, we'll see people prosper better. And then in turn, government will prosper in itself.
You've told us in your manifesto that you want to deliver real freedom, borders that work for the island, and an open, honest government that truly works for the island and its communities. How does real freedom differ from the freedom that we already have?
Well, real freedom is freedom of responsibility, freedom of choice, and freedom to express yourself. Now, I believe that we might be under threat from that, through external sources, from the adjacent isle, shall we say.
Right. So it's be a little bit more specific then.
Well, we've seen a number of policies in the UK, such as the Online Safety Act, that are trying to stifle free speech. And people will say spicy things that are wrong. But I don't think shutting down discourse is a good idea.
Is it fair to say that we're all, as a species anyway, we're relatively new to social media, and perhaps some sort of rules need to be set as to how that discourse should take place?
Yes, and yes and no. It's a difficult one, that, because if you try to impose too many restrictions, then you actually... Who's the arbiter of truth? And once you put an arbiter in there, that becomes the narrative.
And I suppose for years, people like me, although possibly people with more training than me, have held people to account. They have given the news to the public, having properly researched stories, made sure that the story that they're being fed isn't just somebody's opinion made up and sent out for a bit of good news. That doesn't happen on social media, does it?
I mean, no.
you effectively, it's anyone who happens to be good at creating content and making their opinions probably more and more outlandish is likely to become popular and influential.
You do see that. You do see people coming up with crazy ideas, and they get a following. But I don't know if people are really taking that to heart. Some people will, some people won't, and then some people will offer counter arguments to it. And that's how it should really work. You offer a better truth.
So the freedom then that you think is one that we're threatened, or that's threatening our freedom, is basically the UK law on control of social media. Is there anything else?
Digital ID, I think, is going to be a problem. Mm. I think that will lead to further restrictions.
And yet, most people these days do most of their interactions with the world using their phone that has things like their bank details or various other details on which they just use. And what's different between that and a digital ID, which potentially would mean you would have less forms to fill in and work to do when you're trying to engage with government?
Well, I work in IT, as you know, so I do a lot of database stuff. And I just know how easy, at the end of the day, changing a few values in a database table can be. So there is a serious threat that if your digital ID is your passport to everything that you hold, how easy that can be to be hacked and stolen from you. Mm. And once that's gone, what do you do? If you've got no paper to go back to, how difficult is it going to be for you to fight that back? It's going to take you months.
Well, we'll move then on to another of your priorities. I mean, you gave us three, and that was in relation to our borders, borders that work for the island, you said. Well, what's not working with our borders?
Well, we don't know who's coming in, really, do we? That's the big issue. We don't know if they should be here or if they're part of a criminal gang. So if we can passport check, I know people are not going to like passport checks, but we have to do them when we go across anyway, to if we want to go broader. And even then, when we're taking flights, airport usually requires the passport anyway. So why not do it on the steam packet?
Is there not just the faintest whiff of hypocrisy here? On the one hand, you're saying we shouldn't have digital IDs, which potentially could make everyone's lives an awful lot easier, particularly administration and government. And then on the other hand, if you want to go to and from the Isle of Man, you do have to have ID.
If you imagine the Isle of Man with a big border, a big wall around it, I'll actually use the wall. And that's your level of protection. But inside that, you're completely free. That's what we should have.
And you don't think that the Irish Sea provides sufficient of a barrier?
Well, I mean, I'm not proposing actually building a physical wall, but yes.
But I suppose the point I'm making there is it is relatively easy for anybody to get on a boat and travel to the Isle of Man, probably more easy than it is to travel to England from France, because there are so many places that are all surrounding us that people could come from. So actually having secure facilities at our main ports of entry is all well and good. But if people really wanted to get here, they would find ways of getting
and
here.
And then we'll have to adapt.
So is your suggestion then that, in terms of borders that work, isn't it more important to have internal processes that work?
Well, we would need those as well. That'd be part of the immigration process. But if we're checking people's passports as they come in and making sure that those are valid IDs, then we know that that person is a true and proper person, and they can, and if there's any flags on their record.
So are you suggesting that we effectively pull out of the common travel area with the UK and Ireland?
If that's what's required, yeah.
Okay. I mean, there'd be a cost associated with that, wouldn't there?
There's because a cost of everything.
Effectively, we would have to then set up our own immigration service, have our own passport, which probably wouldn't be recognised in most parts of the world.
Well, we've already had some problems with that, haven't we? So,
okay. You say that you want open, honest government that truly works for the island and its communities. Are you suggesting that current MHKs don't want that?
Yes and no.
You'll go far in politics.
I see there's a duplicity there. I see certain individuals and they're acting in certain ways that are questionable from an outsider looking in. I don't want to go into too many specifics on that.
In a way, you kind of are inviting me to ask you to be a bit more specific, because that's an interesting comment you've just made.
Well, we've seen a lack of accountability on certain aspects of policy that's happened in the last 5 years. Certain things have happened and then they've had to counteract.
And is part of that because, you know, ultimately, come election time, nobody wants to claim that they were part of the government. They all want to stand as independents, apart from a few in the Labour Party and one currently in Liberal Vannon. Maybe a few Green candidates coming along too. But beyond that, the government never stands at an election. It's only the individuals who made up that government. And is that, do you think, part of the issue in relation to accountability?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's been a little bit of a clique, as they say. And I don't know. Well, you could use the word conspire, but I wouldn't. I think.
But you just did.
Well, I will track that, but.
So those are your the sort of the priorities you raised with us. I mean, you said you want to see the island and its people thrive into the future. You want a government that's not only reliable but dependable and approachable. what, and maybe this is because it's your first time standing as an MHK, but what I noted about your manifesto is it's big on what you want to change, but it's not big on telling us how you're going to do that.
Well, at the end of the day, I'm just a working dad who's never worked in politics in his life. So I don't know what mechanisms are there, what can be done, what systems that need looking at. So, I mean, if I get in and I'm in a position to do any of these, any things on these, my manifesto, I'm going to be going at it and looking for the best solutions, talking to the people who can facilitate those changes.
And is it your role to only put forward, I think you, what do you describe it as, your principles? You've, mm-hmm. you've list six principles. Is that as far as you can go, do you think? Or do you not think that maybe you have to give some kind of indication as to the sorts of policies that you might be willing to support? So, for example, one of the big issues at the moment is in relation to renewable energy, particularly wind farms. Obviously, candidates are being advised not to speak about specific cases. But in principle, would you be willing to support wind farms, for example?
I'm all for renewables. I think we need to move away from fossil fuels. But I'm more interested in energy security. So, can that deliver? Is it viable? Is it culturally sensitive? Do the people want it? And from what I've seen, the projects that are going on at the moment have been done in reverse. The government has not tried to do the best it can for the people and is now trying to sell them a bad deal.
Some of your principles then, let's look at some of these. Government works for the people, not itself.
Yes.
And your solution appears to be, you will hold monthly meetings with constituents. I mean, that's hardly going to help government work for the people, not itself. It just means that you will be more in tune with the people.
Yeah, well. You, there is a limit to how much you can do, really, isn't there, once you're an MHK? I mean, that's not the best soundbite, but I need to be practical in what I can deliver.
Hmm.
So I would be looking out for my constituents, what their needs are, what their worries are, and I'd be trying to relay that to Tynwald.
Yeah, okay. And in terms of that role, I mean, obviously, politicians, if you go back to the in ancient history and understand what the role of a politician is, it is about persuading people, it is about bringing people along on a journey with you. Is that a skill that you are good at, would you say?
Oh, I've done it at work, yes, certainly. Mm. We've looked at ideas and then I've championed those ideas going forward.
Mm.
And I found that if you have somebody who's championing an idea and then an opponent to that idea, that you can meet together and come up with a viable solution that works for everyone, or at least the majority.
So more talk, do you think?
Sometimes there's more talk. It depends on the situation, really. Sometimes people want action straight away, but that doesn't mean that's a good and fit method.
Mm. Other things then, less red tape. I mean, this is a thing that I think many people will say.
Mm-hmm.
But you say that frontline services are drowning in unnecessary bureaucracy.
Yeah.
But much of that bureaucracy has been put in place because either a Tynwald Select Committee has been established and found that there were various reasons for certain things going wrong, and therefore we need regulation in place to stop that happening. We've got red tape, for example, in relation to food production, which would involve significant procedures to deal with food hygiene.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the kind of red tape that you would cut? What sort of red tape are you thinking about cutting?
I've been speaking to people, frontline medical staff. And the takeaway from that is that they're doing more and more bureaucracy. They're spending more time doing paperwork than they are dealing with patients. Why has that happened? We've also got an increase in middle managers in the healthcare system. So why do we got those, and why are doctors and nurses doing more bureaucracy?
And what are people telling you, or what do you think is the reason for that?
I can't repeat that.
I think you can. I mean,
let's say it's a checkbox exercise. Just covering certain posteriors.
And yet, part of it, I guess, is because we live in an increasingly litigious society, and if anything goes wrong and you haven't ticked a particular box, someone can come after you, whether you are a highly paid consultant or maybe a less well-paid medical practitioner on one of the wards or whatever it may be. The bureaucracy is there to protect the workforce.
Bureaucracy is there to protect the system.
Okay.
So the middle managers and the upper managers should be protecting the system and should be ensuring that the people down the chain are doing the right stuff.
Do you suspect then that we are too risk averse in the way we do
government? In certain ways, yes. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. So then, what else have we got? Put the Isle of Man interests first. Mm-hmm. You've mentioned about the borders, and that's all well and good. But we briefly touched on the break in the current links with the UK. That would be a massive, massive undertaking for Isle of Man government to try and take on if that was to be broken.
Yeah, I agree. But do we want to go that way? That's the other question. Do we want to copy what the UK does every time? And I think a lot of the time we copy what the UK does because it's easy, convenient, and something to hide behind.
Hmm. And another of your suggestions is push back against the nanny state initiatives and excessive government interference. So what bits are you against? I mean, is it about encouraging people to lead healthier lives so we have a less expensive health bill at the end of the year?
No.
And discouraging people from using resources more efficiently, stopping road safety campaigns? Which bits of the nanny state is it that you don't like?
Oh, I don't like anything that's trying to ban stuff. I don't want people's choices taken away from them. If people want to do something, they should be able to do it.
Hmm. But people aren't allowed to drive recklessly through the middle of towns, are they?
No, we do have the laws for that sort of thing. Yeah. But there's road safety laws. But that's not impinging on your personal freedoms.
So is this more of a question of degrees, you would say? It's not so much the nanny state that you are against, it is where the nanny state becomes too interfering.
It becomes the initiatives to constantly. Enough is never enough.
Hmm.
That's the problem.
Yeah. Another thing you say is you support better support for families and businesses.
Mm-hmm.
We need to encourage the best in our young people, help families afford homes, support our pensioners, and back local businesses. And I don't think any politician would disagree with any of that. But these are big ambitions, and you don't give us any detail as to the sorts of things you mean, and you don't give us any idea as to how much any of this is likely to cost.
Well, we've seen at the moment the government has not invested in our youth. They are more interested in allowing external workers come in to take those jobs. I think that's created a problem. That's created a problem for our youth, them finding work. That's created problems for our housing and our medical systems.
And in terms of, well, yes, let's talk about housing then. What any specific policies in, with
well,
regard
to? Well, we would need to look into what we could do for that. Mm. But ideally, we would need to look at a proper first-time buyer scheme. We need to make sure that those housing stocks for first-time buyers remain in first-time buyers' remit. Mm. So they can't just sell them on to an investor or a second home buyer. So it goes to another first-time buyer. Mm. And when we do new developments, we should have a proportion of first-time buyer homes or apartments.
And don't we already have that in
the we did have. I don't know if it's still going. I know, I mean, I looked at, when we first moved over here about 15 years ago, I looked at getting onto that. And I was earning just under the threshold. And then with my wife, we went and we had a chat to the department about it. And they said, oh, you're earning too much. And I said, okay, so if my wife goes on the dole tomorrow, we'd be eligible for the scheme? And the guy said, yes, you would. And I said, how's that a fair and equitable system?
And I suppose one of the problems with being in government, as you will find, is there always has to be some cut-off point, doesn't there?
There does, yes. And I can understand where that came from. But at the same time, it just seemed a bit counterintuitive that you would then take more out of the system than you were putting in.
So we are getting close to the end of the programme, but one more question before we wind up. In terms of the steam packet, you seem to be suggesting that we stop the steam packet from making a profit and instead plough that back into cheaper passengers and freight charges. But that's going to come at a cost, isn't it? Because government paid a lot of money to buy the steam packet.
I think that would pay dividends, though, because you're, at the moment, travel is becoming more of a luxury. To go across is becoming a luxury. Now, if it's run at cost, that it's cheap, and everyone can do it, it's going to be economy of scale. More people are going to come in. More people are going to come over for tourism. More people are going to be going back and forth for little shopping trips. Freight's going to be cheaper. Businesses are going to do better. So the island will prosper, and in turn, the government will prosper. I mean, it will take a little while to tick up, but I think that's the better way to go.
Well, we have now just got a couple of minutes left for you to tell us, in a nutshell, why people should vote for you.
Well, because I'm going to listen to them. I'm going to sit down and I'm going to listen to their grievances, their issues, and I'm going to try my utter best to understand them and take that forward and apply a decent and proper solution.
That was Hugo Yates, who's standing for election in Douglas North. Also standing in the constituency are David Ashford, Peter Washington and Jason Cheatham. You can listen back to this interview in full, along with all the others as part of this series, shortly after broadcast at your usual podcast provider. And to find out more about the general election, which is taking place on Thursday the 24th of September, you can head to our dedicated website, which you can find over at manxradio.com.